today's show, part two of my interview with Chris Johnson, my friend and colleague from KXLU, known to KXLU listeners as Big Red. And after the interview, music curated by Chris Johnson. Stay tuned.
Lagos was the destination. And eventually crossing the desert, then, you know, you get on the other side and things become a little bit less threatening. You know, you can kind of meander as opposed to just keep going. And I found my way to Lagos, which is its own crazy, crazy world. They have something there called Goslow, which is like a traffic jam, but of a different quality, such that on the side of the road, there could be a guy with a little brazier cooking food. He can take your order, cook your food, serve it to you. You can eat it and return the plate before your car moves.
Okay, yes. So a little different experience of traffic.
A number of things, like people who were not that happy to see me coming because they thought that I was poaching, because they had cultural appropriation before cultural appropriation really became a thing. But also...
And you probably had a kind of a striking appearance.
I did have...
Everybody looks at you.
Crowds of children followed me.
Okay.
And, you know, it wasn't terrible because they weren't malevolent.
It wasn't hostile, but no, curious.
Yeah.
So...
And of course, the very different experience of being a real minority, of being, like, oftentimes the only white face I would see in a day.
I see.
So it was a black country, and I was as white a guy as you can imagine in the midst of this.
With red hair. I got it.
So a career in bank robbery was out of the question. But at that time, Nigeria was just recovering from the Biafran Civil War.
Right.
And that was a brutal war of secession. The people with all the oil and all the money wanted to leave everybody else. And everybody else said, nah, you've got the oil and the money, you can't go. And because they were a minority in population, they didn't really have a chance to win the civil war, and they predictably lost, and it was a brutal thing. And the recovery was sort of a painful reassessment and reconvening and returning the nation to a unity, a unitary state. So I spent more time in Kumasi, Ghana, which is sort of the academic capital of Ghana. Accra is the political and economic capital, but it too is kind of a crazy municipal scene where metropolitan areas should not be built in certain parts of the world. And, you know, Tokyo is a prime example, 30 million, Mexico City, 20 plus million.
Manila.
Lagos, Manila. And Accra was kind of like that.
I see.
Kumasi was much easier.
Difficult to live in.
It's prettier. It's not so crowded. And it's where the National University is. So I became kind of an auditor of sorts.
And you learned the language?
No, I didn't. It's an English-speaking country.
Oh, you could communicate.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Like, I had a French girlfriend at the time who made me learn French, so we could get along in Ivory Coast and Senegal and
nice.
In other places and in France. But Nigeria and Ghana are English-speaking. The little countries in between, Benin and Togo, one speaks French, the other speaks English. But in any case, Kumasi is where I learned the rudiments and some of the nuances of African orchestral or ensemble percussion. You know, they have their four drums, three satellite percussion instruments, and, you know, they all have interlocking patterns. You know, one, there's a lead drum, and there's a second, third, and timekeeper. And they all have set parts. The lead drum can call out different things and make everybody else change their parts, but it's systematized.
And this is polyrhythm. And I had a drumming teacher who thought Americans were rhythmically challenged compared to what you find in Africa.
It said jazz is melodically and harmonically complex, but rhythmically simple. And it's pretty true. I mean, the great jazz drummers like Elvin Jones and stuff like that were just monsters. But when they played in support of the bands they were backing, they had a timekeeping function that was rhythmically not really complex. But African stuff, like, completely different ball game. Like, everybody has their own one.
You might have 30 different things happening.
30 different ones.
And the master knows if any one of those people are out.
Somebody said, who's that guy up in front of the orchestra waving his arms around? What's he doing? You know, the violin player plays the violin, the cello player plays the cello, so on and so forth. The conductor is playing the orchestra. He knows everybody's part. You know, he knows the whole shooting match. So same thing for, you know, the lead drummer. You know, he knows where he's going to send everybody when he gives the signal. You know, this is where you change and this is how you change. So it's, a similar thing on a smaller scale. But in any case, it's really syncopated and you don't necessarily follow anybody else's downbeat. You know, your downbeat may be a very different thing from the guy next to you or the guy next to him, stuff like that. You know, you more regularly follow the minor percussion, you know, bells, shakeres, stuff like that. Those things are timekeepers, and, you know, you cue off them more than you do the people playing drums next to you.
And you were good enough so that they welcomed you and took you in?
My most recent performances in Southern California have been at Ghanaian weddings and funerals.
Okay, so you can hold it. And there you go.
let me tell you the common remark. Who are all those Ghanaians up there with Chris?
That's amazing.
Which happened never. I was already, you know, pretty good at Cuban percussion, Latin percussion. So, you know, it wasn't like standard.
But these are derivative of the real African stuff. Many times more complicated.
The real African stuff was another sort of elevation.
Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't quite understand what was happening here, but what a wonderful world to be welcomed into.
It felt pretty good, and you know, I didn't have a lot of money, so I figured I couldn't make any money in Africa, so I had better go back to Europe, where I at that time, you know, I could get a job in music, I could get a job doing a variety of things. The economy was pretty healthy, and so it was a place where I could make money, as a lot of Africans knew and migrated to Europe for that purpose.
Well, it was just a little quick question before we leave Africa. So you have explained how in several situations in your earlier life you were bullied or experienced prejudice for various reasons. But when you were in Africa and part of a musical troupe, was there still that, or did you feel embraced? Were you at home?
It was kind of
okay.
It was like not a big deal in a positive sense, and not a big deal in a negative sense.
So not word hostility, but not people weren't throwing open their arms.
Here's the buona we've been waiting for. Nor was it, what is that guy doing here?
I see.
It was neither of those things.
It was a little
strangely enough, it was most commonly indifference. by the common person on the street. Nobody, you know, gave it one of those, except for the children.
Right. And if you could do play the drums well, we good.
The children may have spoken the adults' minds, but the adults were sort of socialized to the extent that they didn't give in to a tendency to rubberneck, whereas the kids absolutely did. But one last thing on the way out of Africa, I was able to go up the west coast of Africa. They had resolved the kind of quasi-warfare going on in the Spanish Sahara, so I could drive up the west coast of Africa. And I landed in Senegal, where I decided to stay for a time because the music was really compelling. The women were beautiful. The climate was very agreeable, and Senegal was a beautiful sort of colonial city, like Abidjan, Ivory Coast, broad avenues and stuff like that, and you know, not it hadn't deteriorated. It was still in its colonial glory, to whatever degree glory applies. Plus, they had this crazy rhythmic scene going on there called sabar, and they're like 16th notes, and you know, they just cut the bejesus out of time, in sabar there is a downbeat, but what happens in between the downbeat is just whoa, where did that come from?
Yes.
And so that sort of said, well, you know, you got to stop and pay attention to this for a while. So I did, and then continued on and wound up in Paris, where I got a job in a Cuban charanga band. Charanga is flutes and violins rather than trumpet and piano.
Okay.
So the flute is the melodic thing, and the violins play what the piano would play ordinarily in a conjunto or a small orchestra. And it's it was a black nightclub, popular with Parisians who were from former French colonies. And it was just a swinging scene, and we played there four nights a week. And you know, it was a great musical job. And I lost it because I didn't pay my taxes. You know, I had a work permit, but you know, I just kind of blew off the taxes, and so they yanked my work permit.
Oh.
So the club owner said, you know, can't work here.
Wow.
So I went to Germany, the land of full employment, where I ultimately began a garment import-export business, selling bulk denim largely to the Soviets, and Hawaiian and cowboy shirts largely to the Western Europeans.
A little left turn, okay.
Well,
one of the many.
Because, if you're sitting for an interview and the question is, what can you do? The answers are somewhere between nothing and everything. So it struck me that if I said everything, I'd have more options. So it just kind of came to me that this was a timely business opportunity, and I took advantage of it, and it worked out pretty well. So I would import container loads of used American clothing purchased from rag mills by the pound and sell them by the piece. So if you're buying by the pound and selling by the piece, you're making money.
I see. And the Soviets wanted American clothes. They wanted Levi's.
They wanted Levi's. They wanted denim.
And you had it.
And I had it, and I made them pay. ultimately, the woman who was my business partner, whose idea it really was, and I became romantically involved, she didn't want to live in Europe, and so I moved to the United States. We went to Northern California, where we were going to buy a big ranch and, you know, put up a no trespassing sign, and that would be the end of our involvement in the external world. didn't work out quite like that. But
a lot of people have that. I talk to a lot of, you know, modern kind of counterculture people. They want to start a commune, get out of the city. I mean, I've been part of these too, and they rarely work out like the dream.
Remember the people from the Diggers?
Yeah.
Way back when, they bought the town of Black Bear in Northern California, very near the Oregon border, and it's still going as a commune today.
Oh.
But at its inception, it was oatmeal for breakfast, oatmeal for lunch, oatmeal for dinner. And, you know, no thanks. And really classic, dirty, hippie kind of thing.
I was part of a commune in Topanga, and a precious experience, but pretty rough, pretty rugged.
Yeah. What came to pass is while looking for the ranch that we were going to buy, I was mentored by a guy who was in the business of buying and selling ranches.
Okay. So, another left turn here?
Okay. Another left turn, and I've got no way to... I'm not making any money. I don't need to make any money, but this is an opportunity to make money. So I eventually wound up selling rural property to people who wanted to establish communes and...
Okay.
And leave the city behind.
You're a real estate agent then.
I didn't have a license.
Okay.
But I could buy and sell for my own portfolio. You know, I bought it. Where do I advertise it? Okay, you guys. Okay, come on.
So selling it.
Horse trading. You know, horse trading.
That's amazing.
Just
because you know who the people were who wanted this
kind
to
of
pursue these dreams.
You cultivate a
Rajneesh Puram, or
you cultivate a list.
Yes.
That worked out until at the end of the Reagan era, and at the end of the 70s, I think, interest rates shot up to like 21%.
It was crazy for a while.
As they hit 8, I thought, oh boy, 12, wow, that's pretty good. 15, could be a problem. 20, no takers.
Yeah.
So that was the end of that episode.
I remember you get, you know, CDs or whatever they were called back then for 16-18%. That's unheard of.
Yeah, why would anyone work?
Right.
So that period came to an end, but I got sort of attracted since childhood, like standing on the shore of the Pacific Ocean and looking out and wondering, you know, how far could I swim, what's out there, what's on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, et cetera, et cetera. And then I got involved in sailing. And then when I moved to Northern California, I bought a 40-foot sailboat with the idea of doing blue water cruising.
Okay, all right. Another...
Well,
turn in
it's
the life of
kind of
Chris,
kind of the sort of, well, it makes sense from this side of the table.
I see. Right, looking back.
Yeah. But what came on my radar at that time were the Cook Islands. The Cook Islands, there was a guy who lived there in the 1930s and into World War II who wrote a book called An Island to Oneself. And he lived by himself on this beautiful atoll. He had, you know, chickens and things, and he could fish and stuff. But if he broke his arm, he would die.
Yeah. I mean,
he couldn't catch food. He couldn't take care of himself. He'd eventually waste away and die just from a broken arm.
Right.
So, you know, sounds good on paper, practical problems. But
were you looking to kind of like goodbye civilization?
Yeah.
Oh, you wanted to?
I was always kind of headed that way. You know, I mean, that was sort of what Africa was about. That was sort of what ranches in Northern California were about. That's sort of what the communal experience in Venice Beach was about. Sort of alternative ways of living that were outside of the ordinary confines of ordinary society.
There's a theme here that you wanted to get away from all of this chaos and immorality and cruelty and all this crap.
I thought that there might be a better way to live in some sort of intentional way with self-sustaining structures, self-sustaining infrastructures. And that led ultimately to Fiji. And I didn't really start going to Fiji until after Groove Time. But I was fortunate to have a co-host for a number of years from Sierra Leone who had a really, really dramatic stutter. And to this day, I'm particularly prideful that I had a guy who had a really hard time spitting out KXLU.
Oh, gosh.
But he's gone back to Sierra Leone and is an advisor to the president.
All right.
So he wound up on top regardless of any impediments that might have stood in his way.
A great deal of power and inertia, intelligence. By the way, what year did Groove Time start?
87.
Okay.
October of 87. And by about 1991, my wife and I were spending time in Fiji. And we ultimately became minority partners in a little resort there.
Okay.
We had a house on the beach for all of the 1990s. Cost like $110 a month. So we had a little shack on the beach that had running water and a flush toilet and all of the things that you kind of feel are requisites for civilization. But we were looking to buy an island. And we had a couple of possibilities because Fiji is one of the few countries in that part of the world that sells freehold islands. Most of them don't sell. You can maybe lease, but you can't buy. But anyway, we found an island that was just like $1.5 million or $1.2 million or something like that. Well, maybe we could pull that off. Maybe we could scout up that kind of money and acquire the island. Then what? Every nail, every board, everything had to be transported over a lot of water. Then am I going to put it all together? Who else is there to help? And so forth and so on. But it had been done before, like Raymond Burr bought an island there that he developed. Malcolm Forbes bought an island there that he developed. Raymond Burr sold his island to Adi Da Free John.
We know about Adi Da. Yeah. Da Free John.
Yeah.
He changed his name a few times. He started out with just John Schmankowitz, and over the years it became more...
Frank Jones was his birth name.
Yeah.
And he became Adi Da Samraj and all of this stuff. And he got in trouble for keeping a penthouse pet on his island longer than she wanted to stay.
Well, one of the great religious hucksters, certainly.
He certainly got people to kick in enough so that he could buy Raymond Burr's island.
And this is the thing, all of my counterculture friends who want to go out to nature, start a commune. Well, it's one thing, this dream where we're all, have crystals and oming and chanting. It's another thing to get up every morning at 6 a.m. and milk goats. It's like the reality of farm life or the reality of starting a island.
It's hard labor. It's hard
labor. Yes.
And to do it without considerable support, both materially, personnel-wise, and financially, it's a fool's errand. So
starting an island.
Yeah. So
right. Every nail. Yeah. And those are expensive nails to get onto some distant island.
They're expensive to get to Fiji, and then once they're in Fiji, you have to get them onto another boat and onto another island.
Yeah.
Very far away. So gas and crew costs and boats.
So for wealthy people who can throw around cash and hire people, fine. But for a hardworking dude,
the guy who ultimately. Toshiba bought this island eventually, and they were going to make it Toshiba Land, where the Toshiba employees would have their own sort of vacation island, but that didn't work out, so they sold to the guy who started Oakley Sunglasses, and to this day he's never developed it. He owns another island nearby which is developed somewhat. but he hasn't done anything with this particular island. But the next island over is owned by the infamous Mel Gibson.
Oh, interesting.
And we didn't want to buy that one because one of the colonial planters, they grew copra, they grew coconuts, and sold the meat from the coconuts. That was the business in those days. Some people wouldn't evacuate from the island, so he herded them into a cave and blew up the cave. And
Jesus.
And the Fijians have long memories, and they think, you know, someday we're going to get that back, and we're going to get our revenge on whoever is in charge of that place at that time. So we thought that, you know, that's asking for trouble. Mel Gibson doesn't seem to think so.
I see. Well, did you get in with the religious or ceremonial parts of the Fijian culture? I know they drink kava, and there's a lot of ceremony to culture.
Like Hawaii, Fiji was unified in the latter part of the 19th century.
But it wasn't a part of the Hawaiian Empire, the Polynesian?
No, it's a Melanesian place. So they're dark people. And
separate culture
and
from Hawaiians.
There were Tonga is on one side, Vanuatu is on the other side. Tonga is kind of Polynesian, Vanuatu is kind of more Melanesian.
I see.
So the Fijians had their own scene going on, 300 islands, and they, you know, from time to time fought with the neighbors. But by and large, Fiji was a unified entity for a long time, but not unified politically. There were just tribes here, tribes there. But in the middle of the 18th century, like Kamehameha in Hawaii, the Fijians had a paramount chief who unified all the islands.
Oh.
And like Hawaii, as soon as that was done, the colonial power came in and said, we'll take it from here. And so in Fiji, it was the British.
And, we'll take it from this.
And you know, it's a good news, bad news thing. Because the Fijians were relieved of the necessity of incessant internecine warfare. So they didn't have to do that anymore.
It was Pax Romana.
So to speak. Pax Britannica.
Okay.
But I'm getting around to answering the question you asked. And it was, the answer is, deprived of their primary occupation, that of being warriors, what do they do? Well, women still had their routine jobs of tending the garden, going out and getting fish from the reef and, you know, picking up things to eat from the reef and stuff like that. So by and large, they had more time on their hands. By and large, they developed more ceremonial stuff. Unfortunately, the stuff that they mostly developed was Methodist.
Oh.
But the thing they liked about Methodism is hymns. And one of the most the thing that first caused me to fall in love with Fiji is walking into a church on a Sunday morning, first day there, didn't know anything, walk into church, and there's everybody belting it out really soulfully, really tunefully. I mean, like they were a practiced choir, and they were not. They were just a congregation. But they all had done this so many times that they knew, you know, how to make it sound good, they knew their part, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just one of the great church experiences of my life. So the indefatigable Fijian spirit caught me pretty much straight away. And we had our house on the beach. We thought we could get an island there. We thought we would, you know, stay forever. We began a business based on science. Making standardized extracts for the food and beverage, nutraceutical, and pharmaceutical industries. Another left turn, as you put it. But there's a problem with doing science in the Pacific, in the South Pacific in particular. Science is predicated on doing things the same way on Tuesday as you did them on Monday. And that just doesn't jive with people's operating standards in that part of the world. You know, if
the culture's a little different.
Well, it's one not characterized by syllogistic or linear thought.
I see.
Like, if A, then B. If A and B, then C. If it's if A, then maybe B, or maybe C, or I maybe see. D. If A and D, then maybe we don't know.
I see.
It can't be known. That cyclical, circular thinking is more the geometric description of the way peoples in other parts of the world think, not in a line, in a
and seeing you at 4 o'clock is 3:30 or 4:30. It's not here. It's 4 o'clock.
And in Hawaii, if the surf is up, people don't come to work. In Fiji, if the fish are running, people don't come to work.
I see.
And you don't contest that. You can't argue against that. There's no gain. You'll never stand. No argument will stand against the fish running.
Okay.
There it is.
That's
right. So we, at the invitation of the senator Inoue and the Japanese powers that be in Hawaii, we moved that processing equipment to Hawaii, which was looking for a low acreage, high yield agricultural products, plural, to replace sugarcane, which was high acreage, low yield. So it was in keeping with what they wanted to do with their modernization of agriculture. But we didn't really care for Hawaii. I mean, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry? If you want tropical paradises, the South Pacific has it all over the Hawaiian Islands.
Hmm.
So we sold that business, and all this time Groove Time was going on, and so I was back and forth. I had a badly lisping co-host, and we continued, and we have family here. We continue to have some family here, so we were never at a permanent remove. And then after Fiji to Hawaii, then from Hawaii we decided, well, let's not stay here. Let's move back to California. And we kept our house in Pacific Palisades through this whole thing. Like, I kept the radio show through the whole thing. From that time, the early 2000s, until this, I've managed a little real estate portfolio, mostly selling, occasionally buying, but mostly selling stuff that was left over from some decades ago, or things that were acquired in the 90s at some point in time. And so that's kind of kept food on the table, the wolves from the door. And here we find ourselves on this lovely August afternoon.
Yes, indeed. Wow. Okay. I'm trying to take it all in.
Well, let me tell you how expurgated this version was.
Okay.
and abbreviated to some significant extent. But, you know, I mean, how much does anybody really care? And how embellished are these things supposed to be? Well, one of the wonderful things about Africa and the South Pacific is people have time on their hands to tell stories. People sit around and tell stories that go on and on and on and on. And people who are good at it, some are good, some are not, or some are less, some are more. It's what they did before radio and television. So they've been doing it for a lot longer than they've been doing radio and television. And it really caught me as a... I mean, it naturally appealed to me as a loquacious person of Irish descent. What we've done today is kind of a piker compared to what a good African or South Pacific storyteller can do.
I see. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, I think if I were to summarize, somehow you have made peace with civilization. You see, I mean, you just seem like a person who's very at peace and doesn't need to...
Well,
go someplace.
There's a wonderful slogan, I think, developed by the guy who started Alcoholics Anonymous, Wilson, in any case, it's grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So, stop short of wisdom, but maybe have developed a bit of clarity of vision to know the things that I can't change, and a bit of peace of heart and mind to accept the things that I can't change.
Yeah, beautiful. Yes, so you have made peace with this chaotic, often cruel world. I have yet to.
It's important that it's not considered a surrender. Winston Churchill said, if you're not a liberal at 20, you have no heart. If you're not a conservative at 50, you have no head. Totally disagree, Winston. If anything, my liberality has deepened over time. You know, I'm more attached to the concepts of equality, justice, and brotherhood than I was when I stood in opposition to so much. Let's say the concept of brotherhood and the commonalities that exist between us all so greatly outweigh the things that separate us, that you know, we're all in this together, and I can see your point of view as you can see mine. And that, I think, is kind of the root cause of why we're sitting here together. You know, you don't question or criticize the things that I say to you. You don't question or criticize the music you hear on Groove Time. And, you know, I similarly respect the things that you do on In a Dream, and recognize that it in its own way is a forward approach to cultural enrichment.
My experience of you is some deep attraction to this man who has a very developed sense of morality, which feels like it comes out of compassion and just caring about people. It's just you like people, you want to do right by people, and you feel for what you're just saying is walking a mile in their shoes, doing unto others, you know, the golden rule. But yeah, there's this humane moral sense about you. I was going to ask you that question, but you started talking about it anyway. Where that comes from?
It is walking a mile in other people's shoes. It if there were to be a single point of attribution, it would be that. Being able to find commonality with people from other cultures, with people from other socioeconomic strata, with people from other cosmological belief systems. In all of that, there are more points of commonality than there are points of separation. There are more there are more commonalities than disparities. Anywhere I've been, high, low, in between, much more that unites us than divides us.
Well, I guess the last point I'd like to make, or just to discuss briefly, is, you know, when the hippie movement, the peace movement, the anti-war movement, the racial equality movement was young, there was segments of it that really believed in rebellion and violence. And, you know, this led to, like, Weather Underground and just some real militant left-wing groups. But also then it went into insanity with Charles Manson and Sin Q, you know, perhaps influenced by the CIA or whatever the stories are, like, dragging the idea of radicalism or rebellion into the criminal. The older I get, the more I feel strongly that you cannot get to peace through violence. You can't get to peace through war. Although we're told this is the war to end all war, this is a just war, peace comes from more peace.
Political power comes from the barrel of a gun. Mao Zedong. These ideas are atavistic. They were the way things were. In my grandmother's time, she was born poor in Ireland. She didn't see a car until she came to Boston. She married somebody who worked in wheat farming in the Dakotas, where the family nearly froze to death, and in the mines in Butte, Montana, where he lost an arm and then he lost his life. And she raised seven children, and we went to her home place in Ireland, and we thought, you know, that's a pretty, why did she have to leave this place? It's a pretty nice house. And the woman who lived there said, no, it wasn't this house. It was where the animals are penned up over here. That's where they lived. And this house was on a hill, and below the house, a green sloping hill fell away to a blue-gray Atlantic Ocean. And at the end of this woman's life, she lived in Playa del Rey at her son's house on the top of a hill, which was a brown sandy slope falling away to a blue-green Pacific. And this woman, a simple country person, must have thought to herself, what happened to me? How did all of these things occur? Well, part of it is because she lived through a period in history when more changes occurred in the 20th century than occurred in all preceding centuries combined. And those of the 21st century will make those of the 20th seem like a piker. Therefore, old ways do not serve. The idea of armed rebellion, violent revolution, conquest through warfare, colonialization for the benefit of the imperial power, out the window. Those ideas are ideas whose time has gone.
Interesting. In other words, it's ultimately ineffective, if not counterproductive, just causing all kinds of havoc and chaos for everyone involved, even those who are on top for a moment.
It drags us into a past we don't really want to revisit. And B, they don't really work.
They don't work.
And so going...
Just creates chaos,
yeah,
and problems. And in a world that's highly technological, it's dangerous.
Let me not be too Pollyanna-ish about things. We can't say as much definitively of this universe as we sometimes think we can. But one of the things that we can say definitively about the universe we inhabit, two things. One, anything seems to be able to happen in this universe. And two, anything that happens twice will happen a third time. That presents a big problem for us. Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Somebody's going to drop one. Somebody's going to unleash one accidentally, on purpose. They mean it. They were sorry. They don't mean it. But
they're about to release over 1 million gallons of radioactive water out of Fukushima.
Out of Fukushima.
Right, yeah.
Into the Pacific Ocean.
What?
We don't tread a broad, open, sunlit highway. Or we do, but it's heavily mined. Or we don't, and we have to tread carefully. In either case, our better instincts are what will lead us through, not our worser instincts. I speak in declarative sentences, and a wise person said, you can define lying by speaking in declarative sentences. So I say these things as though they were so. They may be so, but only based on your confirmation to your experience that they are so. But it seems... It really seems like to get ourselves through this evolutionary bottleneck, we need to measure twice and cut once, as my grandfather the carpenter said, or we need to pick our way carefully, or we need to always enter the situation with a positive outlook and a good heart and an optimistic view, as the natural animal has for its offspring.
Chris, Big Red, KXLU Groove Time, my KXLU colleague and friend. I am very grateful for this time we've spent together.
I thank you very much for the invitation. It could have happened at any point in the past, and by now we could have done it half a dozen times, and it could have been a conversation and a dialogue, which I welcome at any point in the future you would like to undertake such a thing. I know that I sit across the table from a man who is just as he has described me, and one of prodigious intellect as well. So I feel certain that we could fill up some hours in dialogue, less in an interview format and more in a, well, what do you think about that, Pete?
I like it.
And of course, would be happy to do it. Your place is wonderful. Your hospitality is superb. And I thank you again for the invitation.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
so nice. So nice. Do it again. It's so sweet. Nandika.
Oh yes.
It's nice, nice.
camu Congo. Bé, she's the travail. Il faut tout camu Congo. Mama baby neta. Va prendre l'école. Et tout toi qui t'attends. Je sais compter, lire et écrire, coucou libé, coligolico, coulibé, coligoli, coucou libé, coligolico, coulibé, coligoli, coucou libé, cona, coulibé, coligona, coucou libé, cona, coulibé, coligona.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, part two of my interview with my friend and colleague, Chris Johnson, known to KXLU listeners as Big Red. And after the interview, music chosen by Chris Johnson, we heard Gazette by Malathini and the Mahotella Queens, and Bana Bakongo by Mose Sisengo. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.